The Museum of Lennox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based emerging actors and dance school of drama and music university students. Advance tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca.
Contracts, workplace rights, trademarks, even your digital identity online. Law is an everyday part of life, and having knowledge about these topics can help you become a more informed citizen. That's why Queen's is offering the Certificate in Law, an online program designed to provide a foundational understanding of Canadian law through a series of fascinating courses. Discover if law is right for you. To find out more, visit takelaw.ca.
You can hear Pro Bono Radio on most podcasting platforms and broadcasting weekly on CFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston's only campus and community radio station. If you're interested in learning more about Pro Bono Radio, check out ProBonoRadio.com. The Queen's Faculty of Law has been a leader in Canadian legal education since 1957. If you're interested in learning more about getting a legal education, visit law.queensu.ca.
Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Mukhtar Hindi. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics, and aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is called Finders Keepers, and is about the law of finders. This show deals with one of those legal topics that at face value seems really, really simple. But once you get into it, you realize it's much more complicated than it seems. It's one of those areas of law that is filled with twists and turns, and many exceptions and caveats. This nebulous area of law is broad, and I've only selected a handful of cases and ideas to get us thinking. I encourage you to do your own research if you're interested, and remind you that it's not legal advice, but simply food for thought. Now let's dive in. Imagine this. You're walking down Princess Street on a sunny Sunday afternoon when you notice a shiny object below a patio table belonging to a restaurant. You get closer and realize it's a gold bracelet. No inscriptions or clues are present. You ask the passersby and the staff at the restaurant, but they have no idea from where the bracelet came and who its true owner is. To whom does this bracelet belong now? To answer this question, we need to explore the law of finders. This is the term used to refer to the collection of rules governing ownership of lost or abandoned property. Everybody learns a simple rule at an early age: finders keepers. This age-old phrase is both simple and memorable, and stems from the ancient Roman laws codified by Emperor Justinian. The law then stipulated that unowned property became the legal property of its first taker, and when that property that was intentionally abandoned could be claimed by a finder. In cases where the abandonment was unintentional, the owner of the property retained rights to it despite its loss. The British common law, on which our Canadian legal system is based, later refined these concepts into something more. It came to consider finders to be what the law calls gratuitous baileys, kind of like custodians for the rightful owner, and ascribe to them certain responsibilities in relation to the found property, such as caring for the property and making a reasonable effort to find the property's rightful owner. Moreover, whereas the Romans only recognized the finder as being a keeper where the property was intentionally abandoned, the British extended this concept in a watershed case called Armory v. Delamry. Armory was a legal case from all the way back in 1722. It was a dispute over the ownership of a valuable jewel that was found by a chimney sweep named Armory. The story goes that when Armory took the jewel, which was in the setting of a ring, to a goldsmith working for Delamry to have it appraised, the goldsmith removed the jewel from the ring to weigh it, and then returned the ring without the stone. He appraised the stone and offered to pay Armory for it. However, when Armory refused the offer, the goldsmith decided to keep the jewel anyway and refused to return it. Therefore, Armory brought a lawsuit against Delamry. The court thus needed to decide whether either of them had any right to the ring and jewel, since Armory was a finder and Delamere was just a taker. The court decided in favor of Armory, stating famously that, quote, "The finder of a jewel, though he does not by such finding acquire an absolute property right of ownership, yet he has such a property as will enable him to keep it against all but the rightful owner, and consequently may maintain trover." End quote. The case is often cited as the legal precedent for the phrase finders, keepers, losers, weepers. The rule from the case being that the person who finds an object is entitled to keep it unless the true owner can be found. It departed from the Roman law in an important way, as it recognized not only that finders can be keepers for intentionally discarded property, but also for lost or mislaid property as well. However, the law of finders is much more nuanced than this. The courts have added many exceptions and considerations after this case, complicating the finder's keeper's role. One important distinction the courts have made is the difference between mislaid and lost property. The idea is that if context suggests that the found item was placed there purposefully by its owner, perhaps to hide or store it so that they can come back to claim it, then the law should lean towards giving the custody of the item to the occupier. In these cases, the property is not said to be lost per se, and therefore the law of finders and the armory rule doesn't really apply. In this way, they can ensure that the original owner of the item would be able to come back and claim it. On the other hand, the law considers lost property, for example, property that is not hidden or purposefully left by its owner, as belonging to the finder. This is because the policy arguments for mislaid property do not apply. And therefore, the courts usually have no trouble maintaining the finder's keeper's precedent from armory. Another consideration the courts look at is the circumstances where a finder finds an item. For example, in cases where the finder was a wrongdoer, the courts have been reluctant to grant the found item to the finder, believing that a wrongdoer should not be allowed to profit from the wrong. In a case called Baird v. British Columbia, an accused was arrested as part of a criminal investigation for theft, and during the investigation, money and checks were seized by the authorities. However, the investigation was later dropped, with the seized assets kept by the police. The accused then sued for the return of the seized cash and checks. The court denied his claim to the assets, as he had admitted during the investigation that they were stolen. In this denial, the court used the principle of ex turpi causa non oritur actio, meaning from a dishonorable cause an action does not arise, and further said, quote, "The conduct of Mr. Baird, giving rise to his claim, is so tainted with criminality or culpable immorality that, as a matter of public policy, the court should not assist him to recover," end quote. However, as we will come to see in many of the other exceptions to the armory rule, this caveat is not applied uniformly. In another earlier case called Baird v. Town of Francis, where a 12-year-old boy trespassed onto a property and found some money stashed away, he took the money and started spending it. His spending habits made the police suspicious, and they eventually found him and confiscated the money, with the justification that they were going to look for its rightful owner. The boy then sued for the return of the money, and the court there clearly stated that a wrongful taker, such as a trespasser to land, may bring about a lawsuit for the return of the goods they stole against the later person who, in turn, wrongfully deprived them of the goods. The court declined to comment on if the boy had any felonious or criminal intent as a trespasser because they said that the same result would flow regardless. The court presumably ruled this way for policy reasons, different from those in the earlier case, as it did not want people to constantly fight over items if no clear claim to the items was recognized and enforced by the law. Another important consideration that the courts have looked at are the ideas of exercising control over the land and or thing found, and showing an intention to exclude others from it. There exists a general presumption in the common law that an occupier of land has a right to possession of anything attached to that land. Pollock and Wright's essay on possession in the common law at page 41 says, quote, "The possession of land carries with it, in general, by our law, possession of everything which is attached to or under that land, and, in the absence of a better title elsewhere, the right to possess it also. And it makes no difference that the possessor is not aware of the thing's existence. And it seems preferable to say that the legal possession rests on a real de facto possession constituted by the occupier's general power and intent to exclude unauthorized interferences. End quote. However, sometimes this general power and intent to exclude, which is basically exercising control, that is referred to in this quote can be missing, or the item can be considered not sufficiently attached or embedded in the land, rendering the occupier of the land without a right to everything on the land. To explore this idea, we will look at four cases, which each add a little piece to this finder's puzzle. In the first case, called Bridges versus Hawksworth, the story is that a businessman who was visiting a shop found some banknotes on the floor of the shop. Being a good citizen, he left these notes with the shopkeeper in hopes that they would be claimed by the rightful owner. After 3 years, the owner of the notes still had not turned up, and so the finder asked for the notes back. The shopkeeper refused. The court here applied Armory very simply and said that the location of the finding of the notes had not mattered, and that the finders were the keepers as per the rule from Armory. However, this straightforward application of the rule, while easy, is not always consistent. The second case, called South Staffordshire v. Sherman, considered a finder, landowner, or occupier situation with a different view. Here, the plaintiff hired the defendants to clean their pool, and during the cleaning process, the defendants found some gold rings and kept them, refusing to hand them over to the landowner. Let's think about this for a moment. A straightforward application of the rules from Armory and Bridges, which can be summarized by saying that finders have a better claim than all but the original owners, despite the location being the property of another person, would have these rings given to the pool cleaners. The court, however, did not want to incentivize employees and workers from taking things from the owners of a property. Therefore, the court instead decided that the degree of control an owner or occupier of land exercises over their land and found property to be a key differentiator in this case from the ruling in Bridges. It then established two exception rules. One, that when a servant or employee finds an item, he's presumed to have found it for his master or employer. And the second is that there exists a rebuttable presumption that a landowner has a better claim to an item found on the land than a finder, given that they exercise sufficient control over it, it being the land or the item. In other words, the court justified the departure from the rules of Armory and Bridges, which is basically that finders are keepers, by stating that an owner of land is presumed in law to own everything on the land as well, so long as they exercise their ownership rights and demonstrate an intention to exclude others from the land and items. The court explained that in Bridges, the fact that the owner of the shop had allowed the public at large to enter the premises meant that they were not exercising a sufficient degree of control to benefit from this legal presumption, and therefore enabled the finder of the banknotes to acquire a superior claim to the shopkeeper. In effect, what the court seemed to say is that had the notes been found at someone's house, where the owner was clearly exercising their exclusivity rights of ownership, then the notes would have belonged to the homeowner and not the finder. This is an example where we see the ideas of intention and control playing an important role in the analysis. In our third case, called Hannah v. Peel, a court had to decide which rule to apply between Bridges and South Staffordshire. In this case, a soldier was staying at a house that was owned but not occupied by the owner. During the period of his stay, he found a valuable brooch. He was a good citizen and reported this to the police, giving them the brooch so that they may find its original owner. The police, having failed to find the owner, returned the brooch to the owner of the house, who later sold it. The soldier sued to get the value of the brooch back. The court was torn between the precedents of Armory and Staffordshire. As in Staffordshire, the court said that the owner of the land has a right to all the items found on the land given sufficient control was exercised. However, here in Hannah, the court chose to apply Armory, stating that the fact that the owner had never resided in the house and that the soldier had made a genuine effort to find the owner to be key deciding factors. In effect, the court was referring to the degree of control idea, and deciding that merely owning a house while not occupying was not a sufficient degree of control. Therefore, this stopped them from applying the landowner or occupier presumption from South Staffordshire, due to the landowner not exercising the degree of control required. Finally, to finish off this idea of control, we will look at a fourth and final case. It's a relatively recent case from 1982 called Parker v. British Airways. This case's story is a classic finder's case. Basically, a passenger found a gold bracelet at a British Airways airport lounge exclusively reserved for the passengers. Being a good citizen, the passenger asked the lounge staff to take the bracelet and to try to locate its owner. If the owner was not found, the passenger requested the bracelet be returned to him. After the airline failed to locate the bracelet's owners, the bracelet was sold and was not returned to the finder. As a result, the passenger sued the airline for the value of the bracelet. This case turns on the idea of control as well. It is interesting because the airport lounge where the bracelet was found is neither so public as to match the shop setting in Bridges, or as private as to match the hypothetical example of a private home. The court had to decide, effectively, whether the airport lounge was being controlled to a sufficient degree as to meet the requirements set by South Staffordshire, thus giving the bracelet rights to the airline over the finder. The court ruled that it did not, as merely the requirement to purchase a ticket was not an exercise of a sufficient degree of control over the airport lounge, and therefore, the passenger won the lawsuit. So, we can say from these cases that the general rule is still that of armory, that a finder has a better claim against all but the true owners of an item. However, in cases where the item is found on the property of someone, such as their house or land, then they may benefit from a legal presumption enabling them to keep an item, even if it was found by someone else. This presumption only applies if they had exercised a sufficient degree of control over their property and did not let people access their land willy-nilly. The final case we will discuss is one of my favorite finders cases, and it's called Grasstein v. Holm & Freeman. Here, while cleaning the basement underneath a retail store, which was not open to the public at the time, an employee of the store found a locked box. He informed the owner of the store, which is also his boss, of the discovery, and the owner told him that it probably has some tools in it and they should put it away on a shelf. Subsequently to this, the original employee, alongside another employee, got curious and broke the lock on the box, finding money inside. The challenge then becomes to determine whether the basement owner or the employees had the better claim to the money found in the box. The finders here are relying on Armory, Hanna v. Peel, and Bridges to say that they, being the finders, should be given possession of the money. Hello, finders keepers! The basement owner is relying on cases such as South Staffordshire to say that the owner of the land has a better claim to items attached to or on the land, and that an employee finds an item for their employer. This much is certain. The occupier basement owner did not know that the box was there initially, and then did not know that it contained any money. Therefore, it seemed hard to make an argument that the basement owner showed any intention to exercise control over the box or money. The court acknowledged this. The court also, in obiter, or by passing, first decided that the box was lost and not mislaid, despite being on private property that was not open to the public. But how can a locked box full of money be lost? Can you imagine that? It seems to me far more likely that someone locked the box with the money and left it there on purpose. In any case, the court went on to comment on the rule from South Staffordshire that when a servant or employee finds an item, he finds it for his master or employer, and hints that even if the claim turned on this rule, the court would have rejected it since the employee did not find the item in the course of his employment. But does such a limitation stay true to the policy reasons expressed in Staffordshire? An employee could simply return to an item on their worksite after their shift is done, pretend to be walking through the work area, and grab it. Surely that cannot stand. Regardless, these findings set the stage and made the possession analysis that follows necessary. In the court's view, the claim instead turned on the discussion between the employee and the employer, where the employer told the employee to put the box on the shelf. The court saw this as the determining factor, giving de facto possession of the box to the employer. By storing the locked box on the shelf, the store owner was exercising control over it and an intention to exclude others. Moreover, the court likened the box to a building and applied a presumption, as discussed earlier, whereby the owner of a building is presumed to have owned its contents as well. The court said, quote, "And I should think that the same natural presumption in favor of the occupier of a building, which I discussed earlier, exists in favor of the person who has the possession of a receptacle. He is presumed to have possession of its contents, but as it has been remarked, quote, there is no magic in four walls, and the presumption may be rebutted, of course," end quote. Therefore, the court reasoned that when the employees opened the box, that at the time, both the box and its contents had already been under the custody of the employer, and therefore, they could have no claim over them. Now, if that doesn't rub you the wrong way, you and I are not on the same page. First, there is no indication whatsoever that the owner of the basement knew what was in the box. And so for similar reasons, i.e. lack of intention to exercise control, shouldn't the presumption favoring the occupier, or here, as the court argues, the box owner, be rebutted as it was in Hanna v. Peel? Moreover, the policy incentives set by this decision are also problematic. For instance, let's say that the employee found the box but never told the employer about it, and instead went ahead and broke the lock right away. According to the court's analysis, in such a case, it would have likely ruled that the employee had a better claim to the box and money. Do we really want to disincentivize people from reporting found boxes and containers? Surely not. The reason why I love this case is it has almost a little bit of everything. It touches upon most of the important ideas we've talked about and then uses many of the concepts we have discussed. Perhaps most importantly, even though this case features many of these concepts, it applies them in such a novel way, demonstrating clearly how hard it can be for lawyers to predict outcomes in such areas of law where the precedents are so inconsistent. To discuss this case and these trends further, I am delighted to welcome Professor Kim Ji from Queen's Law. Professor Kim Ji is currently serving as the Associate Dean for Academic Policy for Queen's Law. He is also the inaugural holder of the David Allgood Professorship in Business Law and the director of the Queen's Business Law Program. His research interests lie in the areas of corporate law, commercial transactions, and intermediated securities. Furthermore, he was one of my favorite instructors and was my property law professor, introducing me to many of these finders' cases and ideas. Thanks for joining us, Professor Kim Ji. So the first question I have for you is, how is it that there still exist these areas of law where the precedents are so inconsistent?
That's a complicated question, and I'm going to answer it in two parts. One, why do inconsistencies occur at all? And two, why do inconsistencies endure, like they have with the law of finders? So first, why do they occur at all? Especially given that one of the fundamental values of the common law system is that like cases should be treated alike. So one issue here is that no two cases are going to be identical. You know, there will be many situations where you're going to find one or more distinguishing features in relation to each case, and then you'd be able to rely upon those distinguishing features very reasonably to reach opposite conclusions. The other issue is that legal adjudication, legal dispute resolution, that's very much a human process. You know, so you're going to have two legal teams arguing against each other, and those two legal teams will have to make strategic choices about how to frame those arguments. And so what that means is you're going to get some variation on how like cases are argued. And then similarly, judges will have some variation on the values they bring to similar problems. And all of that together makes at least some inconsistency inevitable. Then the other question, why do inconsistencies endure? And you have to remember that law reform is not free, right? It's a very costly process. We don't have unlimited resources. We have to prioritize where we're going to allocate resources. For the law of finders, the relevant questions would be, is the fact that we have an unpredictable law of finders causing any social problem? Are we seeing violence because of it? Do goods cost more in society because of it? Are we increasing litigation costs in practice? You know, the answer to all of those questions is no. You know, that would at least partly explain why we haven't seen a legislative response to the law of finders. It's just not causing a social problem, the inconsistencies.
I see. In any case, do you think that this is a weakness of the common law system?
I wouldn't characterize inconsistencies as a weakness. Any legal system that we could design would involve some trade-offs. You know, for example, the common law can respond to changes in society in a flexible and relatively efficient way. The trade-off is that we're going to get at least some inconsistencies. But it's a trade-off. I wouldn't see it as a weakness.
Well, that's comforting. Do you think that there is a need for legislation in this area, given the inconsistencies and the potential for conflicting outcomes in the common law?
Well, I would say that if our objective is greater consistency, more consistency, then what we really need is a set of common policy goals. You know, for example, we want to facilitate lost objects being returned to owners, and we want to incentivize honest behavior on the part of finders. Once you have that set of common policy goals, you'd start to see some more consistency, or at the very least, some less inconsistency. So your question is, you know, could the Supreme Court help here? The thing about the Supreme Court is that it's not always reliable. You can't always count on it when it comes to consistency. You know, so for example, one of the most unpredictable areas in corporate law is what's known as veil piercing. And in the 1980s, the Supreme Court had an opportunity to consider this area. And in its judicial opinion, at one point says explicitly, veil piercing follows no consistent principle. But then it doesn't articulate a consistent principle. So the courts aren't always reliable. Even the Supreme Court isn't always reliable when it comes to wanting consistency. And then legislation, I've already suggested, the problem with finders is that it's just not worth the cost. Mm. The inconsistency in the law of finders isn't causing any serious social problems. And as a law teacher, I would say, I think finders is a great topic for first-year students as a way of testing their legal reasoning skills.
Gotcha. Well, for me as a law student, this question is quite pertinent. How do you think lawyers should approach such topics, given that the precedents are inconsistent and it can be difficult to predict how courts would rule even if you make a good argument?
I always tell my students that lack of predictability is not ideal for a planning lawyer, but it's wonderful for a litigator. Mm. To some degree, predictability can be negotiated for before the fact through contract, and that's what a planning lawyer would think about. Now, with litigators, lack of predictability creates more work, right? It creates more opportunity. And I don't just mean that in the negative sense. You know, it facilitates opportunism, which of course it does. But there's also a positive spin-off that comes with the lack of predictability. And that is both parties have more of an incentive to negotiate. Neither will want to incur the cost of litigation. And litigators generally always recommend litigation as last resort. Negotiation is always better.
Gotcha. So let's jump into the weeds a little bit. Remember that case Grafstein? Well, in Grafstein, we see the court deliver a 9-page summary of the precedents that we discussed, but then it decided to break off in a 1-page judgment and deliver a possession analysis that seems rather arbitrary. Why do you think that was, and do you think this will further complicate this area of law?
That's really hard to say. We have to remember that it's not only the Ontario Court of Appeals opinion in Grafstein where we see this phenomenon that you're describing. In finders cases, we quite often see more space dedicated to describing past cases than analysis of the present case.
Yeah.
I suspect what's going on is that judges, like all of us, are trying to make sense of a complicated area of law. They're given all these cases to look at by the litigators in argument, and the description of them in judicial opinions is simply an effort to make sense of it all. Do I think this further complicates the law of finders? No. It was already complicated to begin with, and the Ontario Court of Appeal was dealing with a factual situation that was quite unlike all of the cases that had come before. The judicial opinion is just a further illustration of how we just lack a set of common policy objectives in the area. Mm-hmm. For example, we have cases where the outcome was at least in part motivated by a desire to incentivize honest behavior on the part of finders. That motivation seems not to have informed the outcome in Grafstein at all.
Thanks for your insight, Professor Kim Ji.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we end the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussions of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. For more Pro Bono Radio, check us out at ProBonoRadio.com or on most podcasting platforms and broadcasting weekly on CFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston's only campus and community radio station. Today's show was produced and hosted by yours truly, Mukhtar Hindi. We're also proud to have hosted Professor Kimji of Queen's Law. If you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website. Thank you for listening.
Everyone, and welcome to Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Allison, and today we'll be talking about the Supreme Court of Canada's recent ruling this past summer about the defense of extreme intoxication. Please note that this podcast will contain a brief discussion of violent crimes and sexual assault. To give a brief overview on the topic, in 1994, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that extreme intoxication could be used as a legal defense for violent crimes. A year later, Parliament responded to this ruling by changing the criminal code and introducing Section 33.1 that prevented an accused from using extreme intoxication as a defense for violent crimes. Then, in May 2022, the Supreme Court of Canada struck down in the cases R.V. Brown and R.V. Sullivan and Chan the Section 33.1 provision and held that it was not safe under Section 1 of the Charter and declared it unconstitutional. Therefore, in response to this ruling, in June 2022, Parliament enacted Bill C-28 to amend the Criminal Code in response to the new SEC declaration on Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code, ultimately allowing extreme intoxication as a defense for violent crimes. In order to understand the 1994 ruling, we first have to go back and understand the overall defense of automatism and how it operates in the Canadian criminal law system. In 1974, in the case Raby versus the Crown, automatism was defined as a term used to describe unconscious, involuntary behavior, the state of a person who, though capable of action, is not conscious of what he is doing. It means an unconscious, involuntary act where the mind does not go with what is being done. There are two types of automatism that are recognized at law, non-insane automatism and insane automatism. So non-insane automatism is where involuntary action does not stem from a disease of the mind and entitles the accused to an acquittal, versus insane automatism is where involuntary action is found to result from a disease of the mind and is subsumed by the defense of mental disorder. Put a different way, Section 16.1 of the Canadian Criminal Code holds that no person is criminally responsible for an act committed or an omission made while suffering from a mental disorder that rendered the person incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of the act or omission or of knowing that it was wrong. Therefore, it's crucial to determine the cause of the automatism when these cases go to trial. So if the automatism is caused by a mental disorder, then the Section 16 test of the Criminal Code will be met, and the accused will face a disposition as a person found NCRMD, or not criminally responsible on account of a mental disorder. But if the cause is not a mental disorder, then the accused will be acquitted. But once the factual claim that someone is an automaton is settled, the possibility for conviction disappears. They are either acquitted or found not criminally responsible. The underlying rationale for the defense of automatism is that for every crime, you need the actus reus, or the guilty act, and then the mens rea, which is the guilty mind, and that applies to almost all of the offenses under the Canadian Criminal Code. But when you are determined to be acting in this abnormal mental state in which the person's conscious mind is not directing the person's actions, when you know you're acting in this atomic behavior, you're becoming an automaton, the fault elements cannot be made out because the accused is a established for not acting voluntarily. And if you can't have the guilty mind, then you can't make out all elements of the offense. With this factual underpinning of the defense of automatism, we can then go into the case law that brought this about and sort of led to the Criminal Code amendments in 1994 that ruled out the defense of extreme intoxication. I just want to highlight again that we're about to discuss the details briefly of some violent crimes. So the first case I'd like to discuss is the Crown versus Stone. So Stone was driving with his current wife to see his two sons from a previous marriage. His previous wife did not want him to see the two children, and as a result of her reticence, she forced him to take her to the visit and limited the visit to 15 minutes. On the drive back from this visit, Stone's wife berated him in the car and told him that she was going to go to the police with trumped up assault charges. Stone pulled the car over and put his head down. He testified that he blacked out and felt a whoosh go through his body. When he came to, he had stabbed his wife 47 times with a hunting knife that he kept in the back of his car. When this case went up to Supreme Court of Canada, they held that there is a clear differentiation between insane and non-insane automatism for the reasons that I discussed earlier. They then held that true automatism does not result from a disease of the mind. When that happens, it's predominantly a mental disorder. But most noteworthy is that the court sets out the test for establishing automatism. Firstly, at trial, the accused needs to establish a proper basis for the defense of automatism on a balance of probabilities. If this burden is met, the judge must then decide whether mental disorder or non-mental disorder automatism should be left to the jury. The judge must decide whether there is a disease of the mind present. If one is present, then a special verdict will be entered as per Section 16 of the Criminal Code. If none is present, then the only defense of non-disorder automatism can be left to the jury. The question will then be if the accused acted involuntarily on a balance of probabilities. If he did, then he is acquitted. This then leads us into our discussion of the second case, Davio versus the Crown. So prior to this case, it was established that voluntary intoxication can act as a defense in crimes requiring specific intent because it precludes the voluntariness and intent required to commit the crime. However, no decision had been made yet for crimes requiring only general intent since the invention of the Charter in 1982. The facts of this case are that the accused was an alcoholic and he delivered a bottle of brandy to a 65-year-old woman in a wheelchair. She had one drink and then fell asleep. The accused, who had already had 7 or 8 beers during the day, drank the rest of the 40-ounce bottle of brandy. This put him at a level of intoxication that would lead to a coma or death in most people. He then sexually assaulted the woman. However, he testified that he was so drunk that he did not remember any of what had happened. The court held that the strict application of the rule that the mens rea or the fault requirement of a general intent offense cannot be negated by drunkenness offends both Section 7 and Section 11D of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and they also held that this could not be justified under Section 1 of the Charter. They further held that the mental aspect of a crime is an integral part of the crime, and to eliminate it would be to deprive an accused of fundamental justice. They further held that self-induced intoxication cannot supply the necessary link between the minimal fault requirement required for the offense and the actus reus or the act requirement. They also detailed a flexible approach where evidence must demonstrate such an extreme intoxication that there was an absence of awareness which was akin to a state of insanity or automatism. The biggest takeaway from this case is that for extreme intoxication to be used as a defense for general intent crimes, it must rise to a level akin to automatism. In response to this ruling, Parliament enacted Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code. In brief, this section holds that it is not a defense to an offense that the accused, by reason of self-induced intoxication, lacked the general intent or the voluntariness required to commit the offense. For the purposes of this section, a person departs markedly from the standard of reasonable care generally recognized in Canadian society and is thereby criminally at fault where the person, while in a state of self-induced intoxication that renders the person unaware of or incapable of consciously controlling their behavior, voluntary or involuntary interferes or threatens to interfere with the bodily integrity of another person. These new provisions, or new at the time of the Criminal Code, rule out the ability to argue that one's extreme self-intoxication can rise to a level akin to automatism and eliminates it as a defense to general intent crimes. So this was the law in 1994, and then in 2022, the summer of 2022, the Supreme Court of Canada reviewed two cases that ended up changing this holding and the defense of extreme self-intoxication. I just want to put another brief reminder that we are going to be having a discussion of the facts of some violent crimes. The first of the cases at bar in front of the Supreme Court of Canada was the Crown versus Brown. So in this case, the accused consumed alcohol and magic mushrooms, which have a hallucinogenic effect. He was found to have been in a psychotic state at the time of the crime and had no willed control over his actions. The accused broke into a home and attacked the occupant. He then broke into another home, and at which point the occupants of the second home called the police. He was charged with breaking and entering and aggravated assault. The Crown invoked Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code as a means of precluding the accused from relying on self-induced intoxication akin to automatism as a defense to the charge of aggravated assault. The accused then challenged the constitutionality of Section 33.1. In the appeal, the judge concluded that Section 33.1 violates the principles of fundamental justice and that the presumption of innocence guaranteed by Section 7 and 11D of the Charter and that the violations are not justified pursuant to Section 1 of the Charter. The judge then declared Section 33.1 of no force and effect, and the accused was acquitted on all charges. The Crown then appealed, and it went up to the Supreme Court. The second case at bar in front of the Supreme Court was the Crown versus Sullivan and Chan, which was actually two appeals that were heard together. So first dealing with Sullivan, so the accused voluntarily took an overdose of prescription drug and fell into an impaired state and attacked his mother with a knife and injured her gravely. He was charged with aggravated assault and assault with a weapon. Chan voluntarily ingested magic mushrooms, attacked his father with a knife and killed him and seriously injured his father's partner, and he was charged with manslaughter and aggravated assault. Both Sullivan and Chan argued at their respective trials that their state of intoxication was so extreme that their actions were involuntary. The Court of Appeal held that Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code violated Section 7 and 11D of the Charter and is not saved by Section 1. Sullivan's convictions were set aside and acquittals were entered, and a new trial was ordered for Chan because no finding of fact had been made in respect of non-mental disorder automatism. At this point, I want to take a bit of a detour and talk a bit more in depth about the facts of the Crown versus Chan, just because I think the facts in the case are a bit more applicable to the listeners of this podcast, as Chan was a 19-year-old college student from Peterborough, Ontario. I also think that generally the idea of automatism can seem very foreign when people aren't normally reading the facts of cases that deal with automatism, and the state that Chan was in at the time and the 911 call that was recorded and then released to the public, I think is very illuminating as to, you know, what these self-intoxicated states actually looked like when we discuss a bit later on about the implications of the new SEC ruling and what it may actually be applicable to. So in high school, Thomas Chan played rugby and suffered quite a few concussions, which negatively affected his academic performance and ultimately prompted him to quit the sport. Medical experts would later argue in court that the mixing of a chemical within the magical mushrooms that he took that evening interacted negatively with his brain and all the injuries he had previously had, which then would create distressing hallucinations, anxiety, or paranoia. And they also testified that Chan's experience was acute. So I would describe this case as a little bit interesting, since the actual state that Thomas Chan was in was also captured on a 911 phone call, as when Thomas Chan entered the house of his father and was attacking him, his father's partner ended up making a phone call to 911. The audio of this is available on YouTube, but I won't play it because it is quite a bit graphic, but I will read out some quotes that I think can sort of reveal the state that Thomas Chan was in at the time he committed these crimes. So Thomas Chan declared that he was performing God's will and that this house was a house of Satan. He then stated that today was a day of reckoning. He then said that he didn't want to do this. And when police arrived on the doorstep, Chan shouted, "This is a holy place." Chan then became calm for a moment, but when officers attempted to arrest him, he resisted, screaming, "I am God, I will do it again." He then begged officers to kill him, shouting, "Put a bullet in my head." Multiple officers struggled to subdue the teen, and the arresting officer would later testify in court that it was as if the teenager had super strength. And I just think this is important to highlight when we are discussing abstract topics as, you know, automatism and what, you know, self-intoxication rising to the state of automatism may look like. So all three of these cases sort of appealed on the basis of the constitutionality of Section 33.1, and the Supreme Court of Canada heard all three of these cases together and delivered a verdict in the summer of 2022. So in summary, the Supreme Court of Canada held that Section 33.1 breaches Section 7 of the Charter by allowing a conviction without proof of mens rea or the fault requirement or proof of voluntariness. Section 33.1 also breaches the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, which is guaranteed by Section 11D of the Charter. The Supreme Court of Canada explained that there is a risk that Section 33.1 may result in the conviction of an accused person who had no reason to believe that their voluntary intoxication would lead to a violent consequence. It also held that Section 33.1 extends to situations in which there was a foreseeable risk of loss of control and harm. An individual who consumes an intoxicant with psychosis-inducing effects, including those who know they lost control of their conduct while in drug-induced psychosis in the past, will be caught by Section 33.1, and this poses a risk of wrongful convictions. The Supreme Court also further held that Section 33.1 disproportionately punishes for unintentional harm. At that point, Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code was held to be of no force in effect, and Parliament was then pushed to make changes to the Criminal Code that would then allow and incorporate the takeaways from the SEC rulings in all three of these cases. Therefore, in June 2022, Parliament enacted Bill C-28, which would change the provisions of Section 33.1. Firstly, Section 33.1 outlines the cases in which an accused that had self-induced extreme intoxication will nonetheless be held to commit the offense in certain circumstances. So reading it out loud, a person who, by reason of self-induced extreme intoxication, lacks the general intent or voluntariness ordinarily required to commit an offense, nonetheless commits the offense if A, all the other elements of the offense are present, and B, before they were in a state of extreme intoxication, they departed markedly from the standard of care expected of a reasonable person in the circumstances with respect to the consumption of intoxicating substances. Section 33.12 further elaborates on what this marked departure means, saying that for the purposes of determining whether the person departed markedly from the standard of care, the court must consider the objective foreseeability of the risk that the consumption of the intoxicating substances could cause extreme intoxication and lead the person to harm another person. The court must, in making this determination, also consider all relevant circumstances, including anything that the person did to avoid this risk. Parliament also defined extreme intoxication. So extreme intoxication means intoxication that renders a person unaware of or incapable of consciously controlling their behavior. So again, integrating that idea of self-induced extreme intoxication akin to automatism. So, in explaining this bill on its website, Parliament has said that the Supreme Court of Canada was clear that drunkenness is not a defense for committing criminal acts, including assault and sexual assault. The Supreme Court of Canada's decisions do not apply to the vast majority of cases involving a person who commits a criminal offense while intoxicated. The Supreme Court of Canada ruling applies only in the rare instance where a person chooses to ingest substances that cause intoxication so extreme as to result in a state of automatism and then harms another person. The Supreme Court of Canada also made clear that alcohol alone will almost never result in a state of extreme intoxication akin to automatism. While such cases would be rare, the effect of the Supreme Court of Canada decisions was that individuals who negligently self-intoxicate to an extreme level, lose control over their actions and harm others, could have escaped criminal consequences. This was the case even in situations where a reasonable person should have known that they could lose control and harm others, and the person made no effort to minimize that risk. So these amendments to the Criminal Code, as well as Parliament explaining its rationale for amending the Criminal Code and the SEC decisions and their final impact, it's clear that they're trying to make it clear that usually self-induced intoxication due to alcohol alone will not exonerate someone, and it would only apply in cases that it rises to this extreme level of automatism. And I want to highlight, again, tying it back to the discussion earlier about automatism in general, is that this would then be non-insane automatism, which would then entitle the accused to an acquittal. You can't be convicted of any crime when it is determined that you were in an automatistic state. And I also want to highlight that what's baked into the new version of Section 33.11 is that someone who does enter a state of self-induced and extreme intoxication can still be held guilty and found that they committed the offense if they, before they got intoxicated, they departed markedly from the standard of care expected of a reasonable person. And this can sort of be determined by a myriad of factors, right? But one of the ones that is highlighted is anything that the person did to avoid the risk that their, you know, state of self-induced extreme intoxication could pose, which is a very interesting distinction. Nonetheless, in their decisions, the Supreme Court of Canada held that this would not apply to self-induced extreme intoxication of just alcohol alone, and if it did in very rare circumstances. And you can see Parliament echoing this sentiment when they discuss the reasons for enacting Bill C-28. Ultimately, this new offense of Section 33.1 reverts back to the Supreme Court of Canada's logic in R.V. Davio and goes directly contrary to the provisions that Parliament had enacted in 1994 to go against that ruling. So with sort of this understanding now of where automatism was and then where it's sort of come into now in the context of self-induced extreme intoxication, I want to talk about the criticisms and the support of the bill, as well as any, you know, social media and public backlash for Bill C-28. So first, starting with the criticisms of the bill, more than a dozen women's organizations pleaded with the government to slow down and treat their concerns about Bill C-28's effectiveness seriously. So research showed that extreme intoxication succeeded in 6 of 30 cases in the years between the Crown versus Davio and the passing of Section 33.1 before it was amended by Bill C-28. And alcohol was the main intoxicant of many of these cases. So after the new Section 33.1, the defense was raised 86 times to date. This can prolong the trial process and plea deals and also affect the likelihood of victims reporting the crimes, which are already criminally underreported in the Canadian criminal justice system. Additionally, criminal lawyers will now be able to raise self-induced extreme intoxication as a defense more frequently. Additionally, it is argued that the Supreme Court of Canada, in their ruling in R.V. Brown and R.V. Chan and Sullivan, that a future law restricting the defense of self-induced extreme intoxication could be constitutional if it required the Crown to show that an extremely intoxicated accused could have reasonably foreseen both that he would lose control and that harm to another would result. However, as we know from reading the new Section 33.1, Parliament did not choose to do so. So, in general, the criticisms get at the idea that Parliament had many ways to skin the cat that the SCC sort of set out for them, and they chose to do it in a way that many women's rights groups feel don't adequately address the problem. And additionally, there's also this argument that it might honestly open the floodgates and exacerbate existing problems within the criminal justice system. These criticisms also hinge on the fact that between the Davio decision that allowed for the defense of self-induced extreme intoxication and the first iteration of Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code, which absolutely banned that defense, alcohol was the main intoxicant. So the argument being put forward here is now that we've opened the floodgates again, they're expecting and they're arguing that there may be the same pattern enacted in 2022 and beyond. And obviously, this goes against Parliament's expressed intentions, as well as the expressed intentions in the Supreme Court of Canada's decisions, where they outright said that alcohol would not be the main, you know, intoxicant for self-induced extreme intoxication. However, on the flip side, it's argued that the standard for extreme intoxication is high. There must be expert evidence that the accused was so intoxicated that he was operating as an automaton, not only aware that he was committing a crime, but unable to even control his body. And additionally, that's compounded by the fact that at trial, typically both the defense and the Crown will produce their own experts that will then contest and talk about the accused state of mind at the time of the crime, and both of them can argue opposite things that then, you know, get put in the hands of the jury to make the ultimate determination. So there is an ability to argue that, you know, the self-induced extreme intoxication is not high enough to meet the bar of a state of automatism. Additionally, the medical community believes alcohol alone would not be able to cause such a state, and the defense would only succeed in the rarest of cases. However, that does beg the question of when it does succeed, what are the implications, especially considering all the criticisms that I've just laid out? So with that, there's no surprise that there was a absolute backlash on both social media and in-person protesting. So one of the first things I want to talk about is an infographic I saw got circulated quite a bit, as well as most people in general on social media posting a general outrage at the ruling handed down by the SEC. So the infographic that I saw most frequently and the one that I think is most applicable to specifically what we've discussed is, you know, how since Section 33.1 was enacted in 1994, there have been 62 attempts, regardless, to raise a defense of extreme intoxication, even though at that point, Parliament had expressly ruled it out. All but four of the perpetrators in these cases were men. 31 of the cases involved sexualized assault or intimate partner violence, which are crimes that are disproportionately affecting women and are linked to gender inequality. And 49 of these 62 cases involved female victims. Furthermore, Indigenous women, Black women, and other racialized women, women with disabilities, immigrant women, and LGBTQ plus folks, particularly in the transgender community, and sex workers are far more likely to experience violent victimization. And again, I think that's what the heart of the outrage is sort of saying. It's that, you know, even before when this wasn't a defense that you could use, it was already brought up 62 times, 62 attempts. And now that it's a defense that can be used, when does it actually allow for an acquittal? And it does compound pre-existing issues in the Canadian criminal justice system, such as gender inequality and racism. And not only was there social media backlash, but there were also protests across the country. A big one that I looked into was a protest in Peterborough. And when you look at all the signs the protesters are holding, they say that rape cannot be excused ever and intoxication is not an excuse, which I think in summation is going directly against why the Supreme Court of Canada struck down Section 33.1. And so, in conclusion, the true issue with the extreme intoxication defense is not the Supreme Court of Canada's ruling, but truly it's Parliament's lack of a nuanced approach towards designing an offense that can capture instances under self-induced intoxication that the Supreme Court of Canada deemed could be constitutional. The Supreme Court of Canada suggested that a law restricting this defense could be constitutional if it required the Crown to show that an extremely intoxicated person could have reasonably foreseen that they would lose control and that harm would result. And the Supreme Court of Canada also said that Parliament is entitled to deference when they do design, you know, a charge that would incorporate, you know, some instances of self-induced intoxication. And Parliament could have shown this deference with the way that it amended Section 33.1, but instead it chose not to. So instead, is what's been created goes completely against the intentions of the first, you know, iteration of Section 33.1, which outright, you know, barred the use of a self-induced extreme intoxication defense. And now Parliament has gone completely the other way, the opposite end of the spectrum, where every instance of self-induced intoxication can be used as a defense. And there's no parameters in which case that the Crown could bring forth the argument that the accused should still be held criminally liable for their actions and receive a conviction instead of an acquittal under a self-induced state rising to the level of automatism. So it remains to be seen what will happen with this new Section 33.1 as it currently stands, and if Parliament has any intentions of, you know, further improving upon it, as it only came out in the summer of 2022. So with that, I would like to thank you guys for spending time with me and discussing this new offense. And this has been Pro Bono Radio.
Immigration is at the heart of Canadian culture and industry. That's why Queen's University is proud to offer the Graduate Diploma in Immigration and Citizenship Law, an immersive, full-time, year-long online program that is training the next generation of immigration professionals. Learn from experts in an engaging online learning environment. Build critical skills and real-world competencies that will make you practice-ready for an exciting career. Apply now. Visit immigrationdiploma.ca for more information.
Join us on Wednesday, November 27th for CFRC's 24-hour radiothon. Catch all your regular Wednesday favorites, plus some special one-off live programs during this dynamic funding drive event. The fun begins.